Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to you all. I can't easily express just how greatly I have, speaking purely for myself as director of the RNI, have looked forward to today, and in particular to this evening's event. It's an immense privilege for the RNI to have with us Alexander Butterfield and John Price. They are, if I may say this in front of them, very good and valued friends of this institute. They are important figures in American presidential history. They are windows onto a Republican Party which has changed almost beyond recognition in the 40 years since their service to Richard Nixon. They are both in the broad tradition of moderate pro-civil rights republicanism, a party which once was ideologically broad, plural, complex, in ways which it, for the most part, no longer is. They're wonderful speakers. They're public servants of immense integrity. I first came across them in the Nixon archives when working on an earlier project. And I can say that the richness of their papers is considerable, but the richness of their personalities is even greater. It's simply wonderful to have them here. Now, I'm going to mention Watergate just once, because many people in this room have been thinking about Watergate for much of today in the conference that's taken place here. But I remember, because I watched it on the evening news in the UK, I do remember Chief Minority Counsel Fred Thompson's question to the United States Senate Select Committee on Watergate in July 1973, when he asked our distinguished guest, Alex Butterfield, "Mr. Butterfield, are you aware of the installation of any listening devices in the Oval Office of the President?" To which Alex gave his truthful and now famous reply. But you are saturated with Watergate, and this evening is not about Watergate. It's about placing that complex presidency and that complex man in different contexts and different perspectives, and indeed two perspectives, because, as Alex and John have advised already, and as is unsurprising, they are not going to offer a simple, unified, unitary account of their presidency, but they're going to offer their distinctive perspectives upon the president and upon his presidency, Nixon, president and man. So, well aware of the thrill of this occasion and the privilege of their being here, ladies and gentlemen, I ask you to welcome Alexander Butterfield and John Price.
I am John Price, but I lost the toss of the coin. So looking back, in 1960, Richard Nixon was defeated, as you all know, by John Kennedy for the presidency. And the Republican Party started into a major metamorphosis at that time. There was a vast amount of blame laid on Nixon by the conservatives who were emergent at that time, that the reason for his loss was that he had sold out to people and forces like Nelson Rockefeller. He was the governor, the liberal northeastern governor of New York. And then he went on in 1962, Nixon did, to California, where the right wing savaged him and in part certainly cost him the election for governor, which he was seeking. And Nixon, smarting from this, and we'll hear more about his capacity for resentment and bile, nonetheless, Nixon recognized that the conservatives, the Goldwaterites, were emerging as a very powerful force within the Republican Party. They were working from the grassroots up, capturing precincts and state organizations. I, on the other hand, was firmly in the moderate camp. And also in the moderate camp was an acquaintance of mine, a Senator Hugh Scott of Pennsylvania, who was then the Republican leader in the United States Senate. And he said to me at one point, he said, "Richard Nixon is the man with the portable middle." And there was a lot of truth to that. And so Nixon recognized this Goldwaterite zeal, and he decided to jump in, and he crossed the country back and forth in 1964 to help Goldwater. I was, on the other hand, in the moderate camp and worked for Governor Rockefeller and for another Northeastern governor, William Scranton, who just died last year. Liberals, Northeastern governors. Struck Pat Buchanan, the name you may know, who was later a right-wing candidate for president, when he read my RAI lecture 3 years ago, he said to me, he wrote me a nice note, he said, "You were on the other side of the barricades," which he meant from his heart. He tried to get me fired all the time in the White House. Anyway, I started working for Rockefeller. And there was an interruption in his campaign because he coyly withdrew from the race, hoping that the party would invite him back. And during this interruption in the campaign, I was invited to a dinner, a small dinner in New York, in January 1968, with Richard Nixon. I had never met the vice president before. There was a group of perhaps 12 of us. And I took away and remembered three things from that dinner, which may help you understand Nixon a bit. First, there was a brilliant tactician there by the name of Bob Price, no relation. And Bob Price had run Nelson Rockefeller's successful primary campaign in Oregon in 1964. And Nixon was riveted while Bob Price was there, talking about the politics of the campaign. The second thing was, I remember, that Nixon talked at great length about the importance of the Middle East and the assurance of flows of oil to Europe, and certainly as well to the United States. He cast it in national interest and strategic imperative terms, and I'm sure to Alex and me, that would show the kind of realpolitik which allowed Kissinger and Nixon to find common cause. The third thing was my dialogue with him about welfare reform, and I noted that there was a curious convergence of views between liberals and conservatives on the idea of a negative income tax or a floor under family incomes. And we went back and forth about it, and he allowed that he was not going to campaign for it in the campaign. In fact, he campaigned against it. But he did definitely take on board not just what I said, but the facts that I was alluding to. This was not unlike the caution he showed about any reference to China in his 68 campaign. Weeks passed, the Rockefeller candidacy rose from its winter sleep, and I was asked to run a unit which was looking at the delegate convention, trying to analyze what their pressure points on them might be or what their interests were. And then I was approached after the election, after the primary, to go to work for Nixon, which I did. And Nixon had come through all the intra-party battles of the 1950s. And yeah, he was in many ways a centrist. He was an internationalist. As the party moved more to the right, Nixon was burdened, as I said, with having compromised with Rockefeller in 1960. But interestingly, Nixon, when elected, proved ecumenical in his selection of White House and other administration staff. I was one of three whom Nixon brought in from the Rockefeller orbit, the others being Henry Kissinger and a man named Richard Nathan, who went to the Budget Bureau and then to the Department of Health and Education and Welfare. You also had speechwriters showing different sides of Nixon's interest and persona. Nixon chose Daniel Patrick Moynihan is a top aide. Moynihan was a liberal Democrat from New York who later won election and served, I think, 6 terms in the United States Senate as a Democrat. But Nixon and he were black Irish, and they just resonated with each other. They were remarkably consonant with each other. And this inclusionary staffing by Nixon was not an accident. He had, as I suggested, relations with every faction and player in the party. So I was chosen by Moynihan to work with Pat to put together the Urban Affairs Council, which is something Nixon had asked Moynihan to do. This was meant, in Nixon's mind, to replicate for domestic policymaking that which the National Security Act of 1947 had created for foreign policy, where all the relevant departmental heads would be around the table with the president chairing the meeting. And he approved the membership of it. And then my role was, in the last week or so, was nailing down the paperwork. And on the 23rd of January, just 3 days after the man was inaugurated, we held the first Council for Urban Affairs meeting. Bob Haldeman, the colleague of Mr. Butterfield and the sort of czar of the White House in many ways, noted in his diary that night his disappointment that things were disorganized. And I had actually, we, as I would say, we were 3 days in the administration. There had been an NSC meeting, a cabinet meeting, and people moving into their offices. And I had sent the paperwork a week prior to the Attorney General and to Mr. Ehrlichman, who was counsel to the president. And we had some interesting smoke arising from that. As I say, Haldeman was discouraged. We had a small staff. But it was a start, and this was the beginning of domestic policy formulation. And a forum had been created, which Moynihan and his deputy and I really hoped would prove to be the focal point of domestic policy making. Thanks. With a lot.
Nigel, thank you very much, you and your staff, for setting this up. As you probably figured out, we're beginning this first segment with our beginning of association with the Nixon White House, and from two completely different perspectives, but we hope that this would broaden things for you and make it more interesting. When Richard Nixon was elected the 37th President of the United States in early November of 68, I was serving as the senior U.S. military officer in Australia, reporting assigned to the Commonwealth government, representing the Defense Department and Defense Department activities, and Admiral John McCain, who was the Commander-in-Chief of the Pacific Theater, he was the father of the current Senator John McCain. It just happened, so I was working for him when John, the son, was shot down and went to the Hanoi Hilton. Those were the years, the late 60s, mid to late 60s. I was shortly after that election, and I was probably the only one at the embassy, my office was in the American embassy there, who voted for for Richard Nixon. And you know, the State Department is the department that all Republican presidents resent in many ways, and they want to get their people into it because it's loaded with liberals. And now I'm sort of a liberal. I've changed, cut my stripes quite a bit. At any rate, shortly after the election, I was up in Port Moresby in Papua New Guinea. And I read in the local paper, Tok Tok, T-O-K-T-O-K, that Bob Haldeman, a fellow I had known quite well, immediately after World War II, we were both on the UCLA campus. And our girlfriends were best friends. And I had gotten to know Bob. We'd had a couple of double dates together. And there he is in the Pierre Hotel in New York City, which was the headquarters for the Nixon transition team. And I thought, I got to talk to Bob because I'd just been told I was going to be in Australia for another 2 years. And I loved it there, as did my family, but I was eligible for Brigadier General, and you don't want to be in left field when you're coming up for promotion. And Australia was truly left field for us. We were at war, we either had to be in Vietnam or someplace in Washington, D.C. in a visible office. So I flew to New York, met with Bob. We hadn't seen each other since 1946. We had a great meeting, and he sort of penciled me in as the guy who would be the military assistant to the National Security Advisor. That's a standard job that always goes to an Army or Air Force or Marine colonel or a Navy captain with a master's degree in international affairs. And he said, I got Haig penciled in here too, so it's either Al Haig or you, let me think about it. But we had a good time meeting, and I flew back to Canberra and didn't hear. And finally on the 12th of January, 8 days before the inaugural, I get a phone call at my home in Canberra. And it was Bob, and he said, I'm sitting here with General Andy Goodpaster, who incidentally had been in the Eisenhower White House, years before when Nixon was vice president, and he'd been called back. He was Supreme Allied Commander Europe at the time and was called back to New York to help Haldeman put together some of the principal offices in the new administration. And he said, General Goodpaster has convinced me that I must have a deputy. I had not planned to have one. I don't particularly want one. But you have been in Washington. Unlike most of the California mafia that were heading for Washington to support Nixon, I had been a military assistant to Secretary McNamara for White House matters. And I had worked in the Johnson White House at least 20 hours a week for 2 years. And I wrote McNamara's cabinet reports and that sort of thing. So I had a little bit of that background, which was appealing to Haldeman. So he said, I think you might be the best person that I could select now to be my deputy. And I'm only going to have one. What do you think of that? And I said, I need to know in the next 24 hours. And if you're going to do it, we want you here for the swearing in on the 20th. We don't want people straggling in over the months of January and February. I did have to think about that because there's a long-standing tradition honored by most people. It used to be. No one gives a damn today about this tradition that military people have certain billets in government, and if they take those billets, it's fine. If they get into any policy-making position or any position that may involve policy, they should not be in the military because of the tradition of the military always being subordinate to the civilian element. So that sort of day, the whole reason I wanted to go to Washington is to maybe work there a year and then get over to Vietnam and get a fighter wing. That's what I'd been to Vietnam and flown 98 missions, but it was a temporary duty thing and I didn't have a real command, and that's what I wanted to do. But I didn't want to say no to Haldeman. So I said yes, and a week later I showed up in Washington, and Haldeman said, one thing I didn't say on our phone conversation, and you should really know this, Nixon doesn't like new people. He doesn't work well with new people. Now he tells me that. And he said, you and I is so important that he like you, because that's the whole point. We will be the ones working with the president almost exclusively. So he's got to like you. So he said, I'm going to introduce you when the time is right. And I honestly did it, quite naive. I thought, well, not today, but maybe tomorrow or the next day. 2 weeks later, and I've been hiding behind posters or pillars and things so that I wouldn't scare. He said the president's very sensitive with new faces, so I didn't want to bug him in any way. But Haldeman came running down the hall. It's early February now. Grabs me by the lapel and pulls me, and he said, damn it, this is exactly what I did not want to happen. He said, this is terrible. And he said, come on, I've got to introduce you to the president right now. I've got a car waiting, I'm going out to Los Angeles. Josephine, Joe, his wife, is selling the house. I've got to get there and sign some papers. And he hadn't seen her for months anyway, but he has to fly back to Los Angeles. And he's fit to be tied. And we're both running down the hall. We burst into the Oval Office and surprise the president. But he does get up and come over. He sees that something's up. This isn't the way most people enter the Oval Office. And he walks over, and Haldeman says breathlessly, Mr. President, this is Alex Butterfield. He's the one I told you about. And then he said something about Australia. And I could tell the president didn't know. That confused him. And then he suddenly ran out of gas. As he did that, I looked at the president. He wasn't going to say anything. So I put out my hand and said, Mr. President, a normal thing. It's a great honor to be here. I'm looking forward to working with you and Bob. I haven't seen Bob since 1946 or something like that, but at least it was a normal reaction, I think. Now, there are three people in the Oval Office. Two of us have spoken, and we're both looking at him, and that puts some pressure on him. And he leaned forward. You could tell he was very upset by this. He did not know what to say. And he did this gesture. He sort of assumed that posture you see in caricatures of Nixon, like, oh. And he started doing this, and you could read the gesture. I sort of thought, yeah, he means, yes, Bob did say something about your coming. And that's what he meant, I guess. But he could not utter anything, and he just, these guttural sounds kept coming out. Now, it wasn't German or anything. But he could sound like that. And he just would do the, I was at ease before. Now I'm getting nervous, and I noticed that the president's kind of doing this on the carpet. And a minute or two later, I'm doing that. And all the time, he's just thinking about that staff car outside that's going to take him out to Dulles so he can catch that United 5 o'clock plane. Finally, Haldeman grabbed me the way he did before and said, well, Alex will see you in the morning. He'll be working out of my office, which was the office that adjoined the Oval Office on the west side. And we ran out of there, and Haldeman was just saying, God damn it, running down the hall for the thing. I went into his office and sat down at his desk, and I said to myself, I've just met the President of the United States after waiting in the wings for 2 weeks. And I was in there for at least 4 minutes, maybe not more than six, 4 to 6 minutes. And the man did not utter one single English word, intelligible word, nothing. And I just didn't know what the future held.
Well, this is the part where our stories begin to converge a little bit. We came different paths, as you gathered from the last 15 minutes. Nixon's relentless quest for the presidency resulted at last in the grasp of power. This is key. From the outset of his term, there was unleashed an instinct to take often breathtaking moves in the policy sphere. He was, more than he had ever been, unfettered. He held the office. He now wanted to exercise its powers. A phrase so familiar to his staff was, "This is an historic first." He went for major, often disruptive, policy changes. He came unmoored from party orthodoxy or dogma. Of course, he was responding to the salient issues of his time. Of course, he ran it through political checks and consulting with people. But he was often willing to override objections or the immediate politics and to go public with quite radical proposals. And on this point, one evening, it was Christmas Eve, I was in his office with him, and he was in a very reflective mood. We were talking about the welfare reform, which he had proposed just 4 months earlier, which was putting a floor under family income in the United States. And he said, "You know, John, this is a good idea. It's the right idea." He said, "Annually, the Democrats will vote to raise the level of payments under the floor. Annually, the Republicans will vote not to let that happen and will be defeated. But," he said, "the important thing is that we will establish the principle." His congressional relations staffers went berserk with angst about what was going on the Hill among particularly conservative Republicans. But even liberal Democrats were sort of flat-footed or nonplussed by some of these moves of Nixon. In August 69, he made this speech, which had these new proposals in it. The first was the welfare reform, which I've mentioned, and that was an unchained revision of existing laws, which were a real patchwork of different eligibility standards and quite different rules state to state. The second was general revenue sharing. And the welfare reform caused a deep concern for Republican regulars. But revenue sharing did not offend their sensibilities. It was widely welcomed. It was found money, if you will. It was an income distribution plan, as was the family assistance welfare plan. But this revenue sharing was a distribution to cities and state governments, local units of government. It was to take part of the tax revenues that the federal government efficiently raised and then redistribute them with basically no strings attached to cities. It flew in the face of years of great society programs of Lyndon Johnson and they were often trying to straitjacket the way in which money could go into localities through so-called categorical grant programs. Revenue sharing had been embraced in principle by the Republican Governors Association and also lots of officials at local levels. Democratic mayors, which were prevalent in the country and still are, Democratic mayors were as upset as Republican mayors by the fact that under the Great Society and the poverty program, monies were going to insurrectionist groups or to confrontational groups or dissidents, and they were not going through City Hall. So the Democratic mayors bought into revenue sharing in a big way, as did their Republican pals. Then somewhat later, special revenue sharing occurred. This was a bit more subversive than the general revenue sharing, because what it did was to take existing programs, not new money, and to break down the walls between them and to turn over these streams of money for housing and urban development, for job training, to, again, to mayors and state governments. An early initiative, and I count this as one of the single most important things of the Nixon presidency, was a dramatic expansion and restructuring of the food stamp program, which was a form of income assistance. It was made a lot more cohesive across state lines and resulted in vastly greater purchasing power for families who were very, very low income. This powerful assistance to the poor has become what is called the SNAP program. You may have heard that currently, Supplemental Nutritional Assistance Program. And it was fought over in this current Congress. It is, as we speak, demonized by conservatives for the vast dollars it spends and seen by others as an essential help for struggling families. And as a prescient Nixon told me on that Christmas Eve as the sun was setting, he said, people would fight in the future over the levels of assistance. They are. And they'd argue about budget impacts and the needs of the indigent. He might have said to me of this program, too, the important thing is that we will have established the principle. Welfare reform never passed. Food stamps are there. Also, by the time Nixon took office, the environmental movement was beginning really to gather momentum. There were things like a river in Cleveland, Ohio, being on fire, which stirred some people's concern, and fisheries and oyster beds and things like that, which were by now just barren and unproductive. So most of the environmentalists initially were Democrats, some Republicans. And Nixon acted slowly on this, but when he finally took the initiative, it was important. And he might have had in mind 100 years earlier, or 60 years earlier, the Teddy Roosevelt record on environmental programs, which defined the Republican Party and then the Bullmoosers for a long time. What he did was he created the Environmental Protection Administration, and he pulled together 30-plus different categories of regulatory activity from various places, nooks and crannies around the government, putting it under a single administrator. And that fact alone enabled the regulatory effectiveness to be multiplied from the fragmented situation that it had earlier been. Then, if the push on wider food stamps resounds today, as I was just saying, consider the healthcare initiative of February 1971. At the time, Nixon proposed a truly sweeping insurance and supply combination in healthcare. In today's context, with toxic partisan battles about virtually every piece of Obamacare, Nixon's February message stands out. It would provide universal coverage and would impose not an individual purchaser mandate, it imposed a mandate on all employers of one or more employees to provide health insurance for their employees. It was radical. And he also provided a federal subsidy if that were needed for someone to purchase the policy that their employer was offering them. So for its time, it was a breathtaking attempt at social policy, but it didn't get traction in the Congress, as the center could not hold politically. It responded to what I really think Nixon felt as a deep need. It was consistent with the radically new framework of income support that he was fleshing out, largely with Moynihan in his first year or 18 months. But he ultimately could not bend the politics to his will. Some of the proposals found their way into law, but most did not. And as I say, these initiatives mostly happened within the first 2 years of Nixon's presidency. Moynihan's impact was greatest probably in the first 18 months. John Ehrlichman was really responsible for the environmental initiatives of the president and also supervised me on the health insurance proposal in 1971. Nixon all along, though, was looking for ideas. He was trying to tease out proposals from Moynihan and others on the staff. He wanted to start defining his presidency. He was eager to move. He was, you know, pulling against the traces. As a dear friend of mine, a protege of once of A.J.P. Taylor, Alan Taylor at Morehead College, a wonderful man named Timothy Dickinson said to me recently, he said, Nixon was an adventurer looking for a stallion to ride.
You know, Nixon, of course, is known for his grasp of world affairs, and he gets shortchanged when people talk about domestic issues, and John was right at the center of that. Nixon did so many things on the domestic front. And one of the big ones was giving the 18-year-olds the vote. And, you know, if you're old enough to go fight for your country, you ought to be able to go to the ballot box and vote for the candidate of your choice. He was a very thoughtful guy, and I think that's what he must have been doing when he was on his yellow pad. If he was alone, and he was often alone, he liked being alone, he had the yellow pad there. And it wasn't all about affairs of state, it was often about renovating the West Wing of the White House, what I have to tell Haldeman, what went wrong at the last state dinner, and how I've got to get on those waiters that take so long to serve the salad, and that sort of thing. The man was wonderfully prepared to be the President of the United States. It would be hard to imagine someone better prepared. We forget sometimes that he had been a naval officer during the war in combat, commanding a small little logistics-oriented group on Green Island in the Solomon Group. And we started to have a reunion once. We started to have two reunions. One of the people that served with him on Green Island during the war, and I met a lot of those people during the preparations, but the thing never went through. And the other was to have a reunion of his Duke Law School classmates. And that never happened either due to various interruptions. But he was so well prepared to be the president, and I must say, he looked presidential. He kept himself fit. I mean, he was never, flabby here, and very disciplined, and very, very well organized, and diligent. When he read something, or when you gave him something to take back to the residence in the evening to read, he would read it, and he would comment in the thing and come back and put it in the outbox the next day. But disciplined and well organized, you will see constantly. And in the last segment, I will mention again how contained he was. I'll explain it then. So he followed and insisted that Haldeman and I set up a schedule that he could follow, and he would follow. He came to work every day between 10 of 8 and 10 after. He never missed that. The first thing he did is look at his news summary, which Pat Buchanan was responsible for getting on his desk, but I think an underling of Pat Buchanan's named Mort Allen is one of the guys who stayed up all night and did this. So just an abbreviated thing of all the news events on ABC, NBC, CBS. They reviewed the 100, we were always interested in the 100 greatest, biggest newspapers in America based on circulation. And then I took that book and we'll ask Pat to do this and put it in a domestic, the first half was domestic things and the second half were foreign affairs. And it was very valuable to the president. And he wrote in the margin all the time, Henry, take care of this guy. Or who is this son of a bitch, he might say. He's relaxed now, and the profanity came with the territory, I suppose. But the news summary turned out to be quite a record of his moods, his initial thoughts. I liked that so well that when I went to the Federal Aviation Administration, I had a normal little news bulletin thing, but I wrote in the margin. That way the staff, it's valuable to the staff. They sort of know what kind of mood you're in and how these things strike you and what might be coming down the pike for them to do. His actual schedule, after he came in and read the news summary, which took him about 20 minutes, then he saw staff members. Always Haldeman first for 10 minutes or so. Haldeman had been with him for years and knew him intimately well. And then Henry Kissinger for sure, and then maybe one or two others, because we're going now from roughly 8:30 to 10. At 10 o'clock, it was open to appointments, people who had appointments over a period of weeks in advance. And then at 1 o'clock, 10 to 1, a three-hour period for appointments. At 1 o'clock, he went back into a little room which was between what was Haldeman's office then, later mine. About 10 months later, it was mine, this one on the immediate west of the Oval Office. There was a hot plate in there, a little bathroom, and in the back, a cot and a desk. A little single bed and a desk with a lamp. It's the room that Clinton made famous. It's not really a room. It's almost like a pantry. And he would go back in there at 1 o'clock and have a little dish every day of small curd cottage cheese. That's why he was so trim. And then he would take a little nappy. And no one knew, well, everyone knew in close, but no one was supposed to know that he took the nap. And I held a meeting every day when I was in that office the last 3 years at 2 o'clock, which was a meeting about the following day. And we had everyone in there that was going to deal with the president, the doctor, the Secret Service guy, the press, everyone in my office at 2 o'clock. And people who were responsible for meetings for the president had to give to me by 2 o'clock that day the little review of the meeting, who the president was going to meet with, what the real purpose of the meeting was, the real purpose. It might just be a strokes session for a big donor or something. But and then what the guest is liable to talk about or what he might want to talk about and how Nixon should respond, and never to make a commitment. And of course the president knew that. Then the appointments, and he's having a small curd cottage cheese, and then would take the nap. Then he'd get up and shave. He shaved two times a day before he came to work in the morning, and he used an electric razor, quick little shave around 10 of 3, went to his desk. Manola Sanchez, his valet, manservant, gave him a little cup of coffee, and now he's ready to start the second half of his official day, and it would run from 3 to 5:30 or so. Then he'd see Haldeman 5:30 to 6. Haldeman always went home around 6. I don't know how he thought. He was the White House chief of staff. I guess he could do that. Or his wife, Joe, must have encouraged him to do that. But Nixon always stayed till around 10 of 7. He might see a few more staff members. He loved Pat Moynihan, that John Price was so close to. And Moynihan, he just loved the guy. You had to love him. He's a big Irishman, reddish face, and brilliant. That always helps. And I used to get together with him, as I told John, in the evening, and we'd each have a belt down in his office. He had a nice bar down there, and he'd have a scotch, and I'd have a bourbon every night. And he would have just come back from the president's swimming pool, which none of us Republicans on the staff would dare use. But old Pat used it, and he'd come back, you know, with his red stockings on, you know, walking with his hair all the time. Oh, Alex, come on in and have a belt. A great guy, Pat Moynihan was. He and Henry Kissinger were the two Harvard professors that we had on the White House staff. So in the afternoon, I've already mentioned that Haldeman goes home at 6. The president hung around usually until 6:45 or 7 o'clock. And then he left the office, and he did not go toward the residence. Incidentally, Nixon changed the name of the residence from the mansion, which he thought was a little Imperius or something, and called it the residence, which was nicer, or the president's house on the little matchboxes. He went this way across West Executive Avenue to his EOB office, his Executive Office Building office, which was more like a library where you could relax. And that's where he had dinner. If one of the girls was coming with a husband or boyfriend, Julie was married before he became president to David Eisenhower, the youngest daughter. Patricia was still not married for most of the first term until she married the Cox boy from New York, and they had the wedding there at the White House. But if it was going to be a family affair, he would go home. But I was crazy about Pat, and I met with Pat two or three times a week, at least three times, I guess, a week, around 10 in the morning. And he didn't treat her well. I know he loved her, but he didn't treat her well. But he showed his affection for the two daughters. But he would go over there, and there was a kitchenette over there, so Manola could fix a real dinner. He'd have maybe a drink, maybe a wine, maybe a little scotch, and dinner, and a red wine with the dinner, and stay till maybe 10, just with the yellow pad, always writing on the yellow pad. I can't emphasize, I mean, you don't believe me probably, but this is what he did all the time. And around 10 or 10:30, he'd go back to the residence, and that's when I would go home. I was in trouble, too, with my wife. I never did leave until he was at least in the residence. Now, I have mentioned how he could not cope very well with when he's caught off guard, as Haldeman and I had caught him off guard clearly. If he'd had that thing on his desk that says Haldeman's going to bring in the man that's going to be his deputy, something, he would have excelled. He would have been perfect. He handles those things, and he's a quick study. He would just glance at it. But we caught him off guard, and he could not cope. He was the same way with modesty and shyness, and he couldn't bring himself to say something that might make him look good. If someone else did, that would be fine. A good example is, I went in one day, this is after I'd moved to the old Haldeman office, and he had thrown out on his desk for me to see a sheaf of papers, maybe 20 or 30 papers with ink handwritten on it, and up in the top it said 2:03 a.m. 2:03 a.m. in sort of a child's hand, pressed hard on the paper, underlined two times. And he just, now he wants me to see that. And I do see it, and I said, is that your draft for the upcoming speech next Wednesday, or something like that, or something that was forthcoming? And he sort of nodded, but so I picked it up, and I didn't know what the hell to do. And I said, you want me to give this to the speechwriters? And he didn't, he could not communicate. And he, more of the guttural stuff. And finally he uttered the word Ziegler. Ziegler was our press secretary. And I was dying to get out of there, so I thought, I'm going to Ziegler's office. So I went into the press office and I said, Ron, come in and help me. I'm playing charades here with the president. Sounds like that's what you wanted to say. I want to do this to him. What? I'm only here to serve you. I would do anything for you. Just tell me, and I will do it, whatever you want done with these papers. So Ron comes in, and long story short, he is no help. There are just three of us in there now doing hand signals and stuff. It was just ridiculous. The long and short of it is that what he wanted Ron to do, this eventually came out, is go out and tell those bastards in the press, he just hated the press, that this president writes his own speeches. You see this? And he stayed up until 2:03 a.m. doing this. And that's what he wanted to. If he could have just had the press compliment him and say, this president writes his own speeches. He doesn't just take a speech and refine it. So anyway, that's the modesty thing. He just couldn't bring himself to say, this is what I want done. On the shyness angle, I've got to say very briefly, and I think I mentioned this to Nigel before we came in, he liked compliments, but if you gave him a compliment, a really good one, face to face, he couldn't stand it. He could not stand it. And Len Garman, your good friend Len Garman, was the first one who told me that when they were working in the law firm up in New York years before. Garman told me, he said, I really got to like Nixon, and he'd been on a trip, and Garman was in the law firm too. And he said, I went down to meet him when the train came in or the plane came in. I told him once, I said, Dick, you know, you're a hell of a guy. I really love you, something like that. And Nixon reared back. It just reared, just a little motion. And Garman, that's the first that Garman understood, that you can't do that. You have to be a little bit more oblique when you give these compliments. But I was saying that in a talk that I gave in Coronado, California, to a Navy group, many of whom had been prisoners of war, naval aviators. And when I finished the talk, they're all retired people in Coronado, Navy guys, a Navy town, Navy suburban town, came up to me, and he had red eyes. He looked like he had tears in his eyes. And he said, Mr. Butterfield, I have to talk to you. He said, you don't know what you did for me. You took the huge weight off my shoulders. When we were prisoners and we came back, they had us all together go to Washington to meet the president. This was in very early 1973. They came back, I think, in January or February. And we went to the State Department, and the president was there, and he addressed us. He said, I used to pray every night. I used to thank Richard Nixon when we were released. You know, they gave him full credit for getting them out of there. That was one of the conditions of the sort of bad deal we made with the North Vietnamese. We left them in the country, but we did get our prisoners back, some of them. And he said, they told us, don't engage the president in conversation. Just go up and shake his hand, thank him if you want, and move on. We've got this huge line here. We don't want to take too much of the president's time. This guy went up and he couldn't contain himself, and he just said to the president, oh, I prayed for you every night, and sort of showed that. And Nixon reared back and put his hands up like this. And this young naval officer thought he had offended this man that he loved so much. And it was really sad. I was so moved that I've given a couple of talks, and I actually start choking up when I tell the story. I'm a little used to it now. I've told it a few times, but that it's just so interesting that Nixon, there again, it's like being caught off guard, can't talk very well. Modesty, can't talk about himself, or the shyness.
My conviction is that Nixon was temperamentally someone who needed to startle, needed to upset the status quo, and to flex the power of his position. Shock and awe need not have been a phrase which was heard only decades after the Nixon administration. Sometimes the willingness to act radically could startle. Al Haig, who's been mentioned by Alex, was the number two guy under Henry Kissinger. He and I and a third person were having breakfast in the White House mess early in 1969. And Haig said, you know, he said, we had this incident where the North Koreans shot down a reconnaissance plane, the EC-121. The incident came to be called the Flying Pueblo incident because there'd been a ship attacked by the name of Pueblo. And Haig said to me, he said, it was all I could do to restrain the president because he wanted to nuke them. And maybe Nixon was just trying to let seep out stories like that so that people would be rather slow to do nasty things to us. But it may well be that he meant it. And yet, strangely, there's the converse of that bellicose and impulsive picture of Nixon. I was just recently there. Alex and I spent 4.5 hours in our reunion after almost 40 years. And out in the back is his gravesite. And It's on the headstone of the gravesite, which is in his hometown, and I'm going to break up too. And literally just yards away from the house where he was born. Is a single, simple phrase. The greatest honor history can bestow is the title of peacemaker. And I'm sorry, he is a most complicated man, and an odious man in some ways, and a brilliant man in other ways. But through all the Sturm und Drang of his politics, and through all the resentments and anger at slights or animus of others, through all the heavy considerations of global strategy and calculus about America using its influence, I believe that Nixon was deeply and permanently influenced by his Quaker roots. He adored his mother, and critics would flinch at what they thought maudlin in his emotional displays when talking of her. But her influence on him was deep and lasting. Anyway, I see his foreign policy as a melding of this foundational and religious tenet with the hard calculus of national interests, with the tendency to be bitter, even splenetic, and finally with an irresistible disposition to surprise, to shift the tectonic plates which had undergirded conventional wisdom, to see openings to the future and to pursue them with determination. Among Nixon's first initiatives were the talks with the Soviets about strategic arms limitations. Nixon had been defined by the Cold War. His anti-communist credentials and bona fides were unchallengeable. But nonetheless, he immediately started an engagement with the Soviets around limiting strategic arms. And 3 years later, in May of 1972, Nixon sat in the Kremlin with Brezhnev, and they inked the anti-ballistic missile treaty, and also the SALT, the Strategic Arms Limitation Agreement. I was sitting at that very moment in the Pentagon with Admiral Zumwalt, the then Chief of Naval Operations, and with Herman Kahn, a man some of you may have heard of, a nuclear strategist, and Albert Wohlstetter, another brilliant nuclear strategist. And we were there after the end of 2 days as the document was being signed in the Pentagon. And some of the military people in the room were just erupting. And Herman Kahn said, this means the Finlandization of Europe, meaning that the allies of the United States would fall away and begin to accommodate to Russia. Nonetheless, this was Nixon, the peacemaker. And it was not just to gain access for American business in Moscow, but it had a larger context. The China moves seemed even more out of character for Nixon. In fact, though, Nixon had mused about dealing with mainland China as early as the 1960 campaign. But he buried his thoughts as he was anxious not to appear weak since Kennedy, his opponent, was attacking the Eisenhower administration for having allowed a so-called missile gap to develop. In the 68 campaign, the one he won, Nixon was ready to declare that relations with China should be normalized. His campaign advisors reined him in. When he did go public, it was not to muse about a change in policy. It was not to launch a debate in the country. It was to implement a transformed relationship visibly and irrevocably. The meetings with Mao, the walks on the Great Wall of China, the essence of the agreement to change our relations with the nationalists and recognize power realities, these were all Nixon at his most transformative and energized. It was also very Nixonian in that it played off China against the USSR as Nixon was moving toward that very SALT agreement in Moscow that I mentioned. Also, in August of 1971, just on the same theme of the abrupt, surprise-oriented, shock value Nixon, in August of 1971, Nixon spurred on, if I can use that image about a Texan Treasury Secretary, rounded on the post-World War II so-called Bretton Woods foundational structures for economic and financial dealing in the post-war world. And he suspended the linkage of the dollar to gold, and he would no longer permit the redemption in gold of dollars presented. And it was a very radical move. Dr. Bowles is the expert on this, so I will leave it to him to explain it to you in more detail. And finally, this is the last point in this section. Nixon in the 71 State of the Union talked about trying to get a hold of the government better. And he talked about creating super departments and people who could better get his policy out to the bureaucrats so that they could reflect that policy. And yet, it really didn't go anywhere because it flew in the face of congressional committee jurisdictions and powerful outside interests.
I mentioned earlier that I eventually moved into Haldeman's office. It was just after the first year. Mr. Nixon called us in, and by that time he was beginning to like me a little bit, and this was really what Haldeman wanted, and I'm working with the president quite a bit by this time anyway. And on the 3rd of November 1969, toward the end of that first year, is when Nixon gave his Silent American Majority speech, where he was really asking for America to join the silent American majority to go along with his withdrawal plan from Vietnam, and that's really what it was all about. And I was given the assignment 2 months before that to make damn sure that there is a strong and positive reaction to that speech. I wasn't even sure how to do that, but I called every human I knew. I called all the Republican chairmen in the 50 states. I called every veterans organization. I called every kind of organization, Boy Scouts, anything that would. And Ross Perot, who was playing us as we were playing Ross, we were after his money to build up the AEI, American Enterprise Institute, which was pretty dinky in those days as compared to the liberal think tank, Brookings. And we wanted to even the score, and we were counting on Ross to give us a couple of the billion. And Ross never gave a penny, but he did promise a lot of things. And I got to know him. I was an intermediary after a while between Ross Perot and the White House. And he was an ankle biter. He was a pain in many ways. But a nice guy. And Ross said, I'll have telegrams and letters. I'll have a locomotive full of those things, and we'll come into Union, whatever the station is in Washington, D.C., and unload it. That, a lot of people said that, but Ross promised that. And there was nothing, no locomotive came out with letters or anything. But there was a big reaction, and Nixon's, it was a positive reaction, and I got a lot of credit for that. There were all these telegrams on his desk for people saying, we're with you, Mr. President. That's what he wanted. And that isn't the reason, I don't think, that I changed. He wanted me to take care of more trivia, and he wanted Bob to be, his time to be more useful. Bob was, like, to him, the assistant president. And so he said, Bob, I'd like you to, you know, I'd like to give, let Alex handle the trivia and all the immediate stuff that comes up here, here right outside the Oval Office. And he didn't tell Bob where he would get an office, another office. The West Wing of the White House is pretty crowded. And but Nixon had been the first president to give the vice president an office, and the vice president's the last guy who needs an office because he's the president of the Senate, and he's got a beautiful office up on the Hill, but he has his executive office, vice president's office, in the EOB over there near the president's library type office. But the president gave him a kind of a ceremonial office, which is the old Sherman Adams office in the White House. The one that Governor Adams had when he was working for, that's right. And so vice presidents get no respect. So Haldeman just went to Agnew and said, Ted, we have to take the office back. He hadn't used it much anyway. He'd given a few medals in it. It was used for presentations of awards. And so Haldeman then got that grand office down at the end of the hall and presumably operated more effectively there and did the things that the president wanted done. And I did get a lot of the trivia, but I was right there, the second, third, and fourth years. I wanted to mention work habits, only two things about Nixon in the working environment. He worked through Haldeman. Well, if you're a senior guy in the White House staff, There are some exceptions, like he liked to meet with Moynihan, and Moynihan was a senior guy, one of the six most senior. We had six slots for people who got executive level pay, the same pay as congressmen and senators. We had six slots, so six of our people got, at that time, $42,500. You know, just before that, the Secretary of Defense got $35,000 a year. Yeah, when I was working for him, that's what he made. And Cyrus Vance's deputy made $30,000 a year. It's just amazing to look back on those times. But he insisted on working through. He worked mostly with Haldeman and had him meet with these people, by and large. And I touched on the his daily, I touched on his daily schedule, and I should have mentioned that about his work habits. I associate those things with his penchant for record keeping. He was absolutely nuts about keeping records. And before the tapes came into play, before he ordered that we install tapes, we had a system called memos for the president's file. Those were supposed to be turned into me. I was sort of the keeper of the memos for the president's file and the enforcer of the system. And that meant any meeting with the president, we put someone in there. Now, Henry Kissinger was in with foreign leaders. John Ehrlichman was in with any governors or even ex-governors. I was in with people, you just go in there and sit. You don't take notes because that might intimidate the guest, but you make a mental, and you'd write a thing, we called them color reports sometimes, give a little color to it. The president was in a good mood. He was happy to see his old friend, and they discussed such and such. It could be something mild like that, or it could have some substance to it, in which case you had to remember that and log it. And just go spit it out. Forget punctuation and that sort of thing. Get something on paper and get it into me. The most delinquent guy was Henry Kissinger. He had these long things to write and a lot of them to write, so he was greatly in arrears on this system. Memos for the president's file. But that turned, you know, those were good records. When we started the tapes thing, Haldeman asked me to put tapes in. I didn't know anything about that either. But I decided to go to the Secret Service. I could have gone to the military. The military has a thing at the White House. You probably know this, called WACA, WHCA, White House Communications Agency. It's run by a 3-star general, and they're all electronic technicians from all services, not just the Army or the Air Force. So the WACA people are around, but military guys get transferred, so they're not as safe if you're doing something you want kept secret. And the Secret Service is pretty dependable and have been over the years. So I went to the Secret Service Technical Security Division to get the tapes put in. Well, you would think, now that the tapes are in, and the system was pretty elaborate, as I think most people know, and this wasn't a little thing that you turn off and on like Lyndon Johnson had or other presidents had. This was, as I say, elaborate, and it was every place. It was all over the White House, in every room, cabinet room, telephones. I lost my train of thought here. When, I'll think of it. When we put in the taping system, you would think that we could discontinue the memos for the president's file. It was kind of a pain anyway, and people were, as I say, always in arrears. But no, we kept that going. So we had two things going there from February 71 on for record keeping. And when people asked the question later after Watergate, why didn't you burn the tapes, Mr. President? They were dear to him. That's the simple answer. He wanted those tapes. That was, he could write his book with those. It's just everything that happened. And I remember when the subject came up, we'd had a postal strike early in the first year. And it was interesting the way that was solved. Everybody came together, Secretary of Commerce, Secretary of Defense, everyone, they would meet, and it was gradually resolved, the postal strike. And Nixon said, damn, I wish we had a record of what we had done. And it was shortly after that that I thought of the tapes. So there was good reason to have them, and I think he thought, as most presidents do, everything here in this White House is going to be mine at the end of my term. And it could never foresee the fact that all those things would be taken over by the government. Now, I've emphasized this thing, or mentioned this thing about Nixon's inability to speak under certain conditions. The last example is something that I think none of his biographers know. I've discussed it with John. John wasn't that aware of it. I don't think Pat Buchanan or some of these people that worked for Nixon during the off years when he was not in office, Dwight Chapin worked for him as sort of a civilian aide for a while. I don't think they know, but I can't judge. I would love to get together with people and ask. Richard Nixon was filled with resentment and hate. Hate. I use the word advisedly, but and it was just in here churning, I think, because when it erupted, he spoke, it was a seething hatred. It was visceral. It was always here. You knew it was always here. I think he was an unhappy man when I think of this. And this was the reason. This was the reason. Not the modesty and the shyness and the awkwardness when he was surprised by something, but this hatred for the privileged people. He, as he said, those bastards that had it all, those bastards that were given it all. He grew up poor. He had two brothers that died of tuberculosis. His father was essentially never a success at anything. He was a motorman. He tried a grocery store. All those things failed. And he knew that the school he went to, Whittier, was a, you know, third-rate college. And while Duke was certainly a very fine law school, he knew it wasn't Harvard or Yale or Stanford. And he had been put down by the press, put down throughout his lifetime. And he wanted to get them. He'd call them them. And we heard that. Steve Bull and I heard that now and then. Haldeman never did mention it to me when I came there, but it was so... Well, once, and he likened these people to the Ivy League, Harvard, Yale, Brown, Dartmouth, those schools. If he met you and sort of liked you, but he heard you were graduated from Brown, he would tend not to like you unless you had already established a relationship, because he certainly liked Pat Moynihan and respected Henry. Henry, incidentally, was a facilitator. I didn't like it when Henry got the Nobel Prize. They didn't ask me about that. But staff men don't get the Nobel Prize. All people are supported by staffs. And Henry was a staff guy. I mean, Haldeman chewed Henry's rear end all the time. He was just a staff guy. And yet they made him, I think he was Time Man of the Year, too, at one point. So anyway, very inappropriate, I thought. So this hate that I was in there one day, and he said, "What the hell is the president of Harvard doing on the premises?" The guy's name was Bok. Remember B-O-K, who was president of Harvard in the 70s. And I said, "I don't know." So I picked up the phone on his desk, and I called the usher's office. All the ushers are retired Secret Service agents, and they run the residence. And there are usually four or five of them on duty. Rex Scouten was the head guy. And I said, "Rex, we hear that," I don't even know his first name, Derek, "but President Bok is on the premises." And he said, "Oh, yes, he is, Mr. Butterfield." And I said, "Would you explain that to me?" Now, he didn't know, but Bok was prominent on the enemies list and the freeze list. We had a couple lists, incidentally. and there was a fine line between you. I wrote Haldeman once. I couldn't keep these lists straight. I didn't know which one was the main list, if you were on this. but something was. One was a freeze list, so people were on it like temporarily for a while, and then they could be off the freeze list. But so he was on the enemies list, and with many, many other people. And he said, "Well, he's in the East Room with the First Lady. She's the honorary chairman of the Committee for the Preservation of the White House. And Harvard is big at loaning things to the White House. Many of the lovely paintings and things around the White House along those corridors are from the Smithsonian or from Harvard and that sort of thing. So he's quite a prominent guy on that committee, and he had every reason to be there, and he's with the First Lady." So I told the president that and thought that would settle it. And he his lip quivered, and he said, "I don't give a damn." He said, "The enemy's list is the enemy's list. If he's on the enemy's list, he's not. What the hell is it for if he's..." And it just went on and on. And so I didn't calm him down at all. All right. He met with Don Kendall. Don was a good friend of his. Don was in, presumably, to tell Richard Nixon what it's like. Don Kendall was the CEO of PepsiCo. And Pepsi-Cola was the big drink in the Soviet Union. And Don was there a lot doing business with the Soviet Union. And he was, the president was going over there, and Don was in there supposedly to tell Nixon how to deal with the Soviets. Well, Nixon didn't like that reason that he was in there. He thought he knew how to deal with the Soviets. But they got talking about New York and people. And Nixon said, "Don, you know, you're a good guy. You came up the hard way." I didn't know that, but I guess Don did. And he said, "You know, after I've been vice president," I think he said, "of these United States," he dramatized it, "for 8 GD years, and when I moved to New York, did one of those fat cat sons of bitches ever invite me to his country club or his GD man's club? Not one goddamn time." He was seething, and he was working himself up talking to Kendall. And I don't like to be profane, but I feel it takes that to let you know how I was surprised. I mean, I was taken aback by this, how deep it was, like a visceral hatred to Kendall. Another incident was when he was going on the China trip. That was huge, the China trip. And Nixon said, "You know, the press are taking, what are they taking, 80 people or something?" Yeah, Bob said something like that. "Do we have a list of those press guys that are going on that trip? That's a plum, you know." And Bob said, "Oh, I know, yeah, a lot of the bureau chiefs are going. Let me see that list. I'd like to see who's on there." So Haldeman brings it, and it's on one of those onion skins, a skinny paper, whatever it is. It's not very clear. But Nixon, you can tell, he's gleeful now. He takes his pen, and he looks at this thing. And he gets down to about the 12th name, and his pen goes down, and he scratches it out, tears the paper. He says, "What is this son of a bitch doing? Look, look who's up. Look, this guy. What is he doing?" Haldeman looks over, and he said, "Oh, well, he's the bureau chief or something. You know, all these guys have been promoted." Nixon, "But don't you remember that article he wrote during the gubernatorials out in California in 1962? These resentments, he had names to all these things up here, and he never forgot. And you would think that as a man gets older, he gets more mellow, more moderate about things. His seemed to intensify. And the reason I emphasize this is this, I believe, is the reason that Richard Nixon made all these poor judgments during Watergate. You do know, don't you, that Richard Nixon directed everything in the White House. Richard Nixon's aides, willy-nilly, did not get him into trouble. That was Nixon's line. That was Nixon's line. He said, "Well, I was busy with the affairs of state, you know. And these young fellows..." I mean, that was the intimation. "These young fellows, well-intentioned as they are, you have to keep an eye on them, and I failed to do that." And he never deviated from that line. That was it, from the beginning to the end, that was his line. But he directed, nothing happened in that White House that Nixon and or Haldeman, and they were both tough guys, they knew each other very well, but if one knew something, the other knew it. At least that's my assessment of it, and I was pretty close. And Steve Bull, who worked with me as staff assistant, he was on the other side, the administrative side of the Oval Office, and he and I sort of worked the Oval Office together. We used to call him, not disrespectfully, but behind his back, "Richard, I'll show those sons of bitches Nixon." That was his aura, was that, "I'll get those people, I'll show them." He wanted to show them. And the final example is after the election, you would think now he's been reelected by a huge landslide. I think it was a record in terms of popular vote. And you would think that now, you know, we're home free, and let's all have a drink or something. That's what I want. He said, he got a few of us in there. Ehrlichman was in there, Haldeman, some of the closer aides to him. And he said, "Now, Bob, the gloves come off. Now we're going to get them. We're home free now, and now we're going to really get them. They think they've seen something," and that's what he was saying, those very words. So the hatred thing is big, and I just don't think many people know it. I've only come to realize that lately.
Well, just a couple of, just a very brief wrap-up from my point of view. I mentioned at the end of my prior remarks that Nixon had tried this effort to restructure the entire government, and it came up cropper. And the reason was not just that it was a, you know, bridge too far in substance, but Watergate. And what happened was that rather than the cabinet members being put even more forcefully under the aegis of the White House, they began to operate with complete independence, and things fell apart, the wheels came off the rails. I think, of course, that that same mentality which led to trying to get complete control of the government characterized the mentality which led to Watergate. And as the defense perimeter of the White House on Watergate shrank, the grip relaxed. And I apologize for my emotions earlier, but how do you assess the pathos of a man like this? So astute, so capable of strategic thinking, so often acting on strong impulses of empathy for the poor and near poor, coming to the end of his presidency. He faced the collapse of support for him, hearing the visitation of Republican leaders in his office from the Senate and House tell him that his presidency was over. Remember I said he loved the phrase, an historic first. Well, his resignation certainly was one. The reality is that he was a tangle of all these qualities, and with them, visceral outbursts of resentment and rage. As Leonard Garment said to me one time, Nixon has an angel on one shoulder and a black angel on the other. And Nixon later conceded he would be known for Watergate and for China. Thus far, history has not disagreed with his conclusion. A fascinating political creature, he was the man with the portable middle. Yet, particularly in the first term, there was a far-sighted framework of policy which embraced and explained most of his initiatives. Perhaps the makeup of the man could have led to no other outcome, a personal tragedy and with profound impact on the public's attitude toward government and those governing. The echoes of Richard Nixon's failed presidency are with us to this day. Nigel earlier asked me, hearing a story that I told him, if I might repeat it for all of you. And this goes forward several years after his resignation. And I was out in Southern California. He was in exile on Elba in San Clemente. And I was having lunch with a buddy of mine who was still in the Nixon ambit. And I had Bermuda shorts on and a t-shirt eating Chinese food. And Ken said, the old man knows you're here. He wants to see you. And I said, I can't, you know, I can't wait like this. He said, no, he wants to see you. And this was when Nixon had had near death through his phlebitis, and he was truly living in exile. He'd been cut off. He had not started his self-reconstruction, which was so powerful the last decade or so of his life. So I went into the Oval Office, to the office there in San Clemente, and as the door opened when we knocked, Nixon was standing there, hello, and he took my hand in both of his and pulled me across the room, the whole length of the room, and sat me down. And this man was so needy. He was so destroyed emotionally. And I felt pity for him. Mm-hmm.
People ask, why did Watergate happen? The answer is pretty simple. It happened because of Richard Nixon. It really did. Nobody who worked for him likes to think that, but the evidence is overwhelming. There were the memos for the president's file. There were tapes every place in the Oval Office, the Cabinet Room, over in the EOB office, the Lincoln sitting room over in the residence where the president spent a great deal of his time, up at Camp David and Aspen Lodge, which was the president's lodge, and on all the office phones of offices that the president occupied.
The evidence is overwhelming. He was clearly the culprit, and yet he was a good man in so many ways, and he had such promise. There are a lot of sort of a study in paradox when you talk about Richard Nixon. We said earlier, he was probably the best qualified man to be president, and yet no one made a greater mess of the presidency than he. He loved his daughters, clearly, and yet he held Pat at a distance for some reason. He wouldn't answer her when she spoke. I was on the helicopter once. I sat here, right opposite him. The Secret Service, the doctor, and the military aides are in the back of the helicopter. And she leaned over and said, like any wife might, and it was Christmas season, roughly. She said, "Dick, look, next weekend, why don't we go up and shop? New York's fine at Christmas. And we'll take the girls and, you know, the chestnuts roasting on the corner or whatever goes on up there. And it'll be fun." And he's doing the yellow pad. And I thought he would answer her, but he didn't. Well, that's hurtful to her. She knows. I hear that. And I often wanted to, she needed someone's arms around her. I don't think he did that very often. And down at Key Biscayne, this is personal, and probably shouldn't say some of these things, because B.B. was his close friend at Key Biscayne, and B.B. lived there, and on the cul-de-sac where B.B. lived, the Secret Service worked out a deal where they bought or leased a house for the Secret Service and a house for Richard Nixon, and another house for Pat. And I mentioned when he went home at night, he usually went that way to the EOB, unless the girls were coming. So that meant Pat was eating alone at that house. And she was so great. I mean, she was not plastic Pat, or what some people used to say. She was very intelligent, and when I think of what she had to endure, and that's such a shame, because he did break down and really broke down at her wedding, because he loved her dearly. Well, you're going to all be crying here pretty soon.
I'm sorry to set the standard. Yes. Excuse me.
So the paradox. He loved the spotlight, and yet he was the most uncomfortable person in the world in the spotlight. He was very pleasant to work with. He really was. He was appreciative of good staff work, and thoughtful and considerate. I had a daughter who was in a terrible automobile accident, she and my wife, and they were in the Naval Hospital there for quite a while. She broke her upper lower mandibula, lost a lot of teeth. He asked me to bring her in when she got out of the hospital, around back, not in the front, so it would show on his schedule. And so she came in, and she was about freshman at the University of Virginia. And he just said, he was real sweet with her. And he said, "See these two teeth? Get my handkerchief out." Not mine, you know. And he wanted her to know that here she was a teenager and she lost a lot of teeth, and that he felt sorry. But he was, and then he insisted that I go down to Puerto Rico. There was no base commander at Ramey Air Force Base, so my family lived east. He wanted me to stay down there for 2 weeks or something like that with my wife and daughter while they healed. They were both badly injured in this. The other guy was killed. It was a head-on. Some drunk guy was going the wrong way on that double highway that goes down to Richmond. And they just hit him. They were out looking for colleges. That's right. She was a senior in high school. But that's a personal thing. But he, I was touched. And Pat was the same way. So he was that kind of a guy, and that's the way many people knew him. And yet, while that's all happening, the tapes are running and making very clear that he could be vindictive, foul-mouthed, anti-Semitic, and anti-African-American, too. You should have said, you know, what he would say about Archbishop Tutu and Martin Luther King, these people. And they wanted him to make it a national holiday early on, Martin Luther King. And he said, not on my watch, no way. There was strictly an anti-black strain there. And the chauvinistic and dishonest and corrupt. Those are facts. That was on the tapes. So he hung himself. He sabotaged his own presidency. That's very clear. And I, like John, felt the last thing I wanted to do is testify. We haven't talked about these testimonies, but when I had to reveal the existence of the tapes, I was asked the direct question by the staff, not by the principals. So that was reported to the principals, and so then Fred Thompson, as a courtesy, Sam Dash let Fred Thompson, the Republican counsel, ask the questions of me, and I knew that how I would look to all my friends over at the White House. And I didn't want to. John Dean was a little more unpopular than I, but there were people that probably wanted to break our kneecaps. And then I was also the first witness before the House Judiciary Committee during its deliberations of impeachment of Nixon. Incidentally, Nixon, 11 or 12 or 14 days after Nixon resigned, the House of Representatives voted to approve what the Judiciary Committee had come up with. So the Senate never got into this. Nixon was never impeached because the Senate never did play a role. And the Senate has to, what's the word?
Try the impeachment.
Yeah. And never did play a role. But the House did vote the three articles of impeachment and voted no on two. There were five articles of impeachment. They were deliberate. Legacies is, I've thought a lot about legacies. What are the legacies of Watergate? What does it mean? John Dean has said that there is no legacy. That's the legacy, is that there is none. And the point is obvious what he's making there. But I can tell you one thing that did happen. As the presidency eroded, and it did under Nixon, but in the company of the Vietnam War, the presidency eroded because of that unpopular war. And Clinton didn't help some of Clinton's shenanigans. It eroded a bit there. And even under Reagan, the Iran-Contra affair helped erode it. All those things in combination helped erode the presidency. As the presidency erodes, the Congress becomes more powerful. There's a shift back and forth through history, but in the days following, the Congress got more brazen with its subpoena power. They didn't used to issue subpoenas very often, but after Watergate, they got the hang of it. and in the company of the Congress getting stronger, the press used to be very deferential to the presidency, with Franklin Delano Roosevelt in his crippled body, and with Jack Kennedy and his girlfriends and things like that. They were always deferential to the president. Not during the Nixon days. They started challenging. I forget the guy's name who first shocked everybody with the way he questioned the president. He was impudent, really.
Shore, Dan Shore.
No, it was Dan Rather. It was Dan Rather who did that, maybe Shore as well. And they're now more challenging. And they still are in many ways. Those old days of the showing deference have gone by the boards. So that's all I wanted to say, but it is a tragedy. The tragedy is that Nixon didn't get out of it what he should have, because he was certainly a good president in many ways. He stands about number three now on the latest things, from the bottom. Number three from the bottom, not from the top. But I'm sure he'll rise in the thing. I'm sure he will in time, just the way Truman did. Truman suddenly got up there. So thank you all very much for your attention. We've enjoyed it.